history, remembering Marshall Field's, and her most recent one, Chicago's Sweet Candy History, both by Arcadia Publishing. And she is here today to discuss Chicago's Sweet Candy History. And Leslie, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tell you what, I enjoyed your book immensely. Got hungry reading it, by the way.
Yes.
I really enjoyed it and was fascinated with the backstory of the candy makers who originated in Chicago. Inventors of candy such as Snickers, Milk Duds, Cracker Jack, Lemonheads, Juicy Fruit, O. Henry, and Baby Ruth. I'm getting a sweet tooth right now.
Yeah.
And the candy magnets were interesting, too, the backstory with them. Wrigley, Curtis, Mars, Brock, Lee, Ferrara, to name a few. And I'm just touching the surface, really. So let's start at the beginning. Why did the candy industry originate in Chicago, and what factors contributed to its growth?
And that's a question that I think everybody, or at least when you start out, because the candy industry in Chicago is huge. You know, growing up, I had no idea just how big it was. And when I give talks about it, I always ask, what do you think was the main reason? Why is Chicago the candy capital of America? And almost everyone can immediately say, transportation, location. And that really is at base it. And what it really gets down to is economics. Chicago is and was, as early as the 1850s, the nexus through which agricultural products of America were flowing, and the nexus of where the transportation networks centered. You know, as early as the 1850s, it's a third of the nation's rail lines coming through Chicago. This meant that you can get agricultural products quickly in the perishable days before air conditioning and high-speed interstate transportation, and you can get finished products out to the stores quickly. The commodities markets were located here. Financially, you make more money in Chicago than anywhere else for years. And that really is the basic bottom line. But one of the things I found fascinating going into this is that it wasn't just location and transportation. It was the fact that Chicago was an immigration center. Candy making was an easy field for immigrants to get into. It was a field where you can start a business with a kitchen and a good recipe.
And a kettle.
And a kettle, yes, as many did.
Just a kettle.
And yeah. Start selling to your neighbors and grow. Very little capital involved in the early days. And Chicago also happened to be a place where you had other candy makers start opening, so you had suppliers start coming in. Chicago was early on a place where you could find sugar makers, sugar product refiners, milk product refiners, candy box makers, flavor extract makers. And the more suppliers are here, the more it makes sense for other candy makers to come here. It's an amazing industrial story.
So corn syrup was big, too, because
yes.
It's agricultural. I mean, you need corn syrup
absolutely.
To make candy.
Yeah. And corn starch. You know, a lot of
corn
candies require that for the molding process. You can get milk. You need milk for, you know, things like chocolate nougat. That's accessible from places like Wisconsin. Even sugar beets, you know, coming from Michigan or the Dakotas, all flowing right through Chicago.
Climate was a big deal, too. Back in the day, they had air conditioning, and this was a cool climate.
It was, and actually, for decades, people forget that chocolate was difficult to produce in the hot summer months. Chicago has a long, cold winter, so you could produce.
Aren't we lucky?
Lucky as far as candy goes.
Yeah.
The chocolate season ran, you know, you could produce it here from October through May. Which in a lot of places, there were chocolate factories that would actually shut down in the summertime because you simply couldn't produce it. And even if you could, retail stores couldn't stock it. People forget that candy was different before air conditioning.
Well, let's talk about one of those candy makers. And I'm actually going to get into gum.
Okay.
Wrigley is just an amazing story. So William Wrigley Jr. arrives in Chicago. I believe the date is 1891.
Yes, right.
$32 in his pocket.
Yes. 29 years old.
Okay, so How do you get a start? What can you tell me about Ripley?
It's a great story. It's one of my favorite American entrepreneur stories. His father was a soap manufacturer, and Ripley he was always kind of a rebel, wanted to be on his own. So he started going door-to-door selling soap, his father's brand of soap. And he was very instinctively drawn to promotions. So he starts offering a can of baking powder with each order. Baking powder became more popular than the soap. So he drops the soap and just starts selling baking powder, and as an incentive, offers a pack of gum with each order. Well, the gum got more popular than the baking powder, so he dropped the baking powder, just started selling gum, eventually bought the gum company and starts producing gum, introduces Wrigley's Juicy Fruit Gum, that was 1893, and Spearmint Gum a few months later. He tried a couple other flavors. I've seen these wrappers for Wrigley's pineapple gum and peach gum.
Well, he was ahead of his time.
But eventually it was just those two flavors. And then Double Mint Gum came out in 1914 for about 60 years. That was all he sold. Three flavors of gum, 5 cents a pack, and of course made enough money to build the Wrigley Building, one of the first skyscrapers on North Carolina Avenue. He bought Catalina Island and a certain Chicago baseball team that still plays in the field named for the Wrigley.
So, quite the marketer, too.
Yes.
So, how do you go about, this is just gum.
Right.
You wonder, a stick of gum, how do you make all this fortune? So, how do you go about marketing gum?
He was a phenomenal entrepreneur as far as advertising goes. Really the pioneer in many modern advertising methods. He was one of the first to use advertisements that are what we see today, ads with bold graphics, minimal copy, very striking colors, and he was willing to think outside the box. One of my favorite stories is one time he sent it was either a pack or a stick of gum to every American family that had a listing in one of the United States telephone books. This was back in 1915 or so when there weren't as many people with phones as there are today. But his theory was, if you could afford a telephone, you could afford to be chewing gum.
That's wild.
One of those crazy things. And this is a tradition that I think Wrigley recently has become much more innovative. Since the 70s, really, that innovation has been a real keyword with Wrigley. But it's still advertising that has made them a powerhouse. Whenever I give talks on this, I ask how many people in the audience can sing the Wrigley's Double Mint Gum jingle.
Double your flavor.
You got it. Double your flavor, right?
I always thought it was kind of weird.
Right. Does anyone ever know what's double about Double Mint? By the way, it's double distilled peppermint. So it's a double flavor, double. I always thought it was double mint.
Exactly. Or maybe a spearmint and a peppermint or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. But the power of songs like that is really gives you an indication of how strong that brand is. I always say to people, take a look when you're checking out at the supermarket, take a look at the gum rack. There's a very likely chance you're going to see either Juicy Fruit, Double Mint, or Wrigley Spearmint Gum.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, that's a phenomenal record. For gum that was introduced in 1893, 1914, they are still flagship gums.
Right. And you're right about the bold letters.
Yes.
Juicy Fruit just sticks out at the airport when you're buying a newspaper. It's right there.
Bold colors. It's not as distinctive today, but at the time, when you see early Wrigley's billboards, they just blow your socks off because they're that bold.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, in a lot of ways, it's fundamental to what Chicago candy entrepreneurs did so, so well. Marketing and advertising, that was their thing.
Let's talk about some other folks, brothers, and they came up with Cracker Jack.
Yes.
Talk about bold. It's popcorn.
I
didn't think about
it's
it.
Popcorn, right.
But the Bruckheim brothers, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we all know the box. I mean, talk about something that just is a brand.
Right.
So
right.
How did Cracker Jack all come about?
Cracker Jack came about because these two brothers, they had a popcorn business and had a combination popcorn popper peanut roaster. And according to London, just started experimenting and came up with this great molasses coating. But this was in sometime around 1890. Most confections at that time were not sold branded. You never went to buy, you know, a Baby Ruth candy bar or a box of Fanny Mae's. You went out, you know, because you had a taste for, you know, candy coated popcorn and peanuts. And that's probably how it was first introduced. It got its name, according to legend, from one of the salesmen who's eaten some of it one of the day, and he said, boy, this stuff is really good. It's a cracker jack, you know, meaning something really great. And they latched onto the name, and it made Cracker Jack one of the first branded confections, meaning something you go out and you look for by brand, which was really fairly new at that time. And when people think about Cracker Jack today, what they typically think about is the great marketing innovation is the prize and the box.
Right.
But really, Cracker Jack's great innovation was the packaging. Because if you've ever made popcorn, candy-coated popcorn, you might know it likes to stick together.
Yeah. So they were able to... What did they do to do that?
They had this very innovative packaging. It was a triple-sealed package.
Yeah.
You, people remember remnants of it from the...
Foil.
Yeah, it was like a wax paper bag inside a cardboard box wrapped in a foil thing. That's a variation of what they had. Was it stayed crisp and fresh in the box. Each kernel was crispy and separate.
Yes.
That's why you could sell it at circuses, carnivals, beaches, holidays. Yeah. Remember, I was speaking of great marketing.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry,
yeah.
Buy me some peanuts and bread. This is why we buy Cracker Jack every Major League Baseball park. But very, very innovative.
So the prize, when did that come about?
That was 1912.
Okay.
And they were not the first to put prizes in candy, they were one of the most successful. Originally, there was a coupon you were supposed to send in for premium, but we all like instant gratification, right? The latest statistic I heard is that Cracker Jack, and I think this is as of 2010, they have given away 23 billion prizes and trinkets.
That is an amazing figure.
Unbelievable. There's an association of people who just collect Cracker Jack prizes, and they can tell you the year or at least the decade that a prize was introduced. And they're very good at noticing, you know, Cracker Jack prizes had to be gender neutral. You know, you couldn't have something too much for a boy or too much for a girl. So unlike, you know, Happy Meals today where you can specify gender. So some things are long-term, you know, joke books, riddle books, temporary tattoos, spinners, those kinds of things.
Right. They kind of went downhill, though, over the decades. Because I remember as a kid, they were just, they were pretty cool.
Right.
Like in a plastic plan or something.
I know. It's all paper now.
Yeah, it's all paper.
All the prizes are paper.
Yeah.
Some of them are pretty.
It's more cost efficient, I'm sure. That's the key.
Yeah, and less likely of swallowing some.
So, speaking of candy makers, that's what we're talking about. Leslie Goddard is here. We're talking about Chicago's Sweet Candy History by Arcadia Publishing. And E-Mail Brock got a start in the candy business.
Yes.
And so what was his deal?
He was a German immigrant. I mean, sorry, he was born. His parents were German immigrants. He was one of those guys who was just always tinkering. He came up with this coffee pot to keep coffee hot when he was still a teenager. Invested in the candy business. It went bankrupt. So he's scraped together about $1,000 and opened his own candy shop. And I love the name. It was Brock's Palace of Sweets. Isn't that great?
There's a great photograph in the book of him just staying out there, almost knowing I'm going to be very rich someday.
And he's sitting in front of this, you know, 16-foot wide storefront.
Right, but very proud.
Very proud. And,
yes.
And you can see in that
photograph. And his glint in his eyes, it just looks like he's going places.
He does. And really,
very confident.
He was driven. And his store, it was on North Avenue in Chicago, right in the German-American neighborhood. And he put a small neighborhood shop. Traditionally, the majority of candy shops in the United States are small neighborhood shops. But you can see from the beginning he's going places. He had a great baked caramel that he sold to all the Chicago big department stores. He was undercutting prices for the downtown stores so people would come to him instead of going downtown. But he loved technology. He started investing in vacuum cookers from an early age and wrapping technology. And as someone pointed out, when you invest early on in equipment that can individually wrap caramels and Starlight Mints and butterscotch discs and the kinds of things we associate with Brock's, that gives you an edge as far as selling candy nationally and and it's what made Brock's the biggest seller of bulk and bagged candies. He opened his store in 1904. By 1923, he opened that famous factory on the west side of Chicago that eventually was, according to Brock's, and I'm sure they were unbiased, the largest candy-making operation under one roof. And
right.
Really, I'm sure they do have a legitimate claim. There was up to 4,500 people working at the Brock's factory during its peak hours.
That is huge.
The biggest seller of bulk and bagged candy. And again, and this really is key to Chicago's candy.
Now, when you say bulk on bulk candy, maybe
yes.
I should specify what that means.
It's
not like a Three Musketeers.
We'll
get the margin
exactly.
A little bit.
It's the kind of candy that you would often sell. You would go to stores and they would have like big bulk bins and you could scoop it out
mm-hmm.
and it's sold by weight, things like that. You know?
And it was wrapped.
But it was often individually wrapped.
Right,
it's
right,
usually
right.
Individually wrapped.
Right.
And again, when people think about Brock, that's often what they think. You know, Starlight Mints.
Yes.
I have a pair of earrings that were sold as Brock's earrings and they were shaped like Starlight Mints. But
how did you get those? That's
I know, I found them on Etsy. I was so excited. Which shows you actually the power of the Brock's. I mean, many
yeah.
people make Starlight Mints, but Brock's, they became, for many, the most famous.
He also had street side vendors with,
yes.
right, which was a good idea.
They did,
as well.
They did. There was a lot of fear in the 19th century about adulterated candy. Some of it just plain on fears about, adulterated candy, but some of it legitimate. There were unscrupulous candy makers who would, add a little shellac to their candies to make them shinier.
That's crazy.
And it grew to be a tremendous fear, not unlike the Halloween candy scares the 70s and the 80s, which again, part of it was overblown, but like a lot of things, there was a basis in truth that it grew from. It was Chicago that was the home of the National Confectioners Association, formed in the 1880s, partly to combat this perception.
Hygiene, health, those
right.
sorts of things. Yeah.
And for a long time, Chicago candy makers really played a significant role in promoting sanitary sealed candies. And for a while, people preferred, candies that came from a factory, well sealed and sanitary. And
well, that makes sense.
It
yeah.
does,
yeah.
yeah. It really does.
Ferrara pan candy.
Yes.
When I think of going to the movies, even today, but the Atomic Fireballs,
yes.
Cinnamon Imperials, Lemonheads. So, unlike Brock, who was from Germany, he was from Italy.
Right.
What's pan candy, by the way?
Is it
as simple as I think it is? I don't think so.
No, I was, when I first heard it, I thought, flat pan.
I can do that.
Panning is a process, and it's actually a long-term tradition. Italians have a great specialty in it. It involves taking large round kettles, and they rotate, and you put in the center maybe a peanut or an almond or a piece of candy, and as it rotates and spins, it's a very skilled process, you pour in a liquid candy solution, color, and flavor, and as it all spins and spins, a candy shell rotates. This is the process by which you make, those little pastel candy-coated almonds. If you've ever been to
sure.
an Italian-American wedding,
Jordan
almonds.
Mm-hmm.
This was it takes a lot of skill, and many Italians came with that skill set. Salvatore Ferrara opened up the Ferrara pan, he opened up a confectionery shop in the Italian-American district of Chicago, started selling this to locals. Eventually teamed up with his brothers-in-law, the Bafardis, and they started panning other sectors, peanuts and candies, and it eventually grew into the candy empire that's now in Forest Park.
What was the first one? The first was there a first candy that they panned, so to speak?
Really, Jordan Almonds, really,
okay.
because, he was making, he also had, it was a bakery, and they were making baked goods as well as candies, like a lot of early
mm-hmm.
candy makers. As far as the candies that are still around today,
Lemonheads and those sorts of things. Yeah.
Red Hots, that was 1932, those little cinnamon imperials.
Made your tongue really red.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
Well, and then it got spicy enough, the Atomic Fireballs, that was 1954. Which,
lasted a long time in your mouth.
Oh, they did. It can really make your eyes water.
Yeah.
And they're great. Ferrara was ahead of the game as far as that. The trend for super flavoring, which is huge spicy. They had super spicy fireballs in 1954.
Wow.
They have some of their other big hits, Jawbreakers, Boston Baked Beans, Lemonheads.
Which one? Boston Baked Beans.
I know. That's clever. Boston Baked Beans. Yeah. There's more Boston Baked Beans coming out of Chicago than out of Boston. Thanks to Ferrara. I love it because, you know, there's a wonderful trend in candy to give candies names that have nothing to do with what they taste like. And Boston Baked Beans are the perfect example. They're candy-coated peanuts.
Right, right.
What a great, fun name.
Yeah, and exactly.
They look like
well, then it's nutritious.
And it's nutritious. So right. That's another big trend.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah. The candy is nutritious. Where did that whole idea come about?
It's Chicago candy makers. They really promoted it. And the person who usually gets the biggest credit is Otto Schmering.
Okay.
Who started Curtis Candy Company.
Sure.
He started Butterfinger and Baby Ruth. Yeah. Right. He started the company in 1916. But at that time, German sounding names like Schmering were not really popular. Mm. So he took his mother's maiden name, which was Curtis, and named the company that. He had his first big hit with Baby Ruth. That was around 1920. And Butterfinger, which was either 23 or 26. In any case, those were his two big hit candy bars, although he had quite a few others. But one of the things he really promoted was that candy is not a luxury or an indulgence. It's not something you buy for a special occasion, like a holiday. This is a food you can eat every day. He was one of the real pioneers in advertising that candy is energy food.
Yeah.
He had these ads that had this great mascot, a little like an athlete with letters on his front saying NRG, meaning energy. And he used the phrase, you know, made with dextrose, the sugar that gives you energy. You know, dextrose is basically a kind of sugar. Well,
right.
So a candy bar is going to be rich in dextrose. He did this great series of ads with athletes where they would do metabolic tests. How far can a 154-pound man run at a speed of 5.25 miles per hour in the muscle fuel in one Baby Ruth? And it's 1 in 5, 6 miles. It's crazy, but it's not crazy because what it's really doing is linking candy consumption with what you need when you need a quick bolst of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we still see that in candy advertising.
Right.
Energy's flagging, you're getting hungry, you're getting, what do they say,
hangry. It just morphed into the Cliff Bar.
There were some early Chicago candy bars that had vitamins added into it, so it was like a really precursor of, energy bars that have protein powder and things like that, but have that candy appeal to them. The tradition between candy and medicine is a long, long-running one, but Chicago candy makers were very, very good at building these links. And really what they're doing is they're building a mass market for candy consumption. They're increasing candy consumption to match the fact that technology had been created that can produce candy at a scale never before imagined, and distribution that can get candy out nationally.
And stay fresh.
Hand in hand.
And stay fresh.
Absolutely, right. Which was a big consideration. Stick candy, hard candy in the early days, that's what people sold nationally. But to sell things like, more perishable candy bars and bonbons and things like that.
Like the L. Henry bar.
Yes.
I want to talk about George Williamson for a minute. So how did that all come about? That's an odd name. Oh, Henry?
It's a great name.
I mean, Cracker Jack,
Exactly.
Rigby's Gum, it's after him.
Yeah, Spoon with Gum.
But O. Henry.
Right there. Oh, Henry is, George Williamson was a really phenomenal entrepreneur. He deserves better remembrance than I think he sometimes gets. He started O. Henry, launched O. Henry in 1920, and it was the first candy bar launched nationally. So they had advertisements in Saturday Evening Post and Boy's Life. Many candy makers sold perishable things only regionally at that point still. This was, 1920, just after World War I. He started selling it nationally. And
what's composed in the what's comprised of?
What's it's so sad that O. Henry is still made, but it's hard to find.
What's the deal on that?
O. Henry today is made by Nestle, which also owns Baby Ruth. Mm-hmm. Now, I've never heard that they're more interested in Baby Ruth than O. Henry. store the other day, and I wanted to buy the whole box. It's somewhat similar to a Baby Ruth. It's got a fudge center with caramel and peanuts on it covered in milk chocolate.
Okay.
Which really is...
Plus, it was like kind of small, too.
Yeah. When O. Henry debuted, it was big. It was a 10-cent candy bar, which, that was a big deal.
Yeah,
candy bars were 5 cents in 1920.
Yeah.
But he advertised, you got a big one. But again, not only is he launching it nationally, first of all, the name O. Henry came about, there are multiple stories, but the most common one is in Chicago, he had a little candy store making candy in the back and selling it in the front, and there were young women who worked the counter in the store. And every day at a certain time, this young man named Henry would come in to kind of flirt with the girls, and he was there so much, they were always asking him to help, and they'd say, "Oh, Henry, so when it came time to name it, they said, one of the salesmen said, "Just call it O. Henry, that's all we ever hear around here." But the benefit of the name O. Henry is that it's easy to remember. And people were still not quite used to asking for branded products at the store. It was still that transition time. People were still used to going in and asking for, Hound Drops. So O. Henry, you can remember it easily.
Jesus is fun. We are talking to Leslie Goddard, author of Chicago Sweet, Candy History by Arcadia Publishing. Now, we come back, we'll explore more of Chicago's rich candy history, including the origin of Demet's Turtles, Mars, we haven't even talked about that,
right.
Yeah. Jelly Bellies and Milk Duds. Yeah, lots going on. You're listening to Word of Mouth. My name is Jim Wendelick. We'll be back right after this. Joining us, we've been talking about the candy men, people like Wrigley and Curtis and some others. And our guest today is Leslie Goddard, the author of Chicago's Sweet Candy History. And we've been going down memory lane and really enjoying this immensely. By the way, the Willy Wonka thing, they have a factory in Itasca.
Yes.
Kind of dull looking compared to the movie. What's the deal on that?
Leslie
Goddard or something?
It's actually, the candies were invented, were introduced after the first movie came out, and some of them were inspired by the movie, some of them not, but...
The candy came after the movie.
The candy came after the movie, yes.
All right.
So they are still made in Itasca, but the factory is just a factory. And like most candy companies, no tourists, sadly.
Well, we've been talking about the candy men who started back at the turn of the century, and then later, a big player, candy magnet, Frank Mars.
Yes. We need to mention.
We've got to talk about Frank Mars. So, what's his story? I understand he started in Minneapolis, but then made his way to Chicago.
He did. Yeah. He started out in Washington State and then Minneapolis. He was his story is amazing because it's not unlike Hershey in the sense that he had multiple flops before he had a big hit. And his first nationally famous bar was the Milky Way. Came out in 1923. There's a legend that he was trying to create a candy bar that tasted like a molten milkshake, which was the new big ice cream treat invented in Chicago, Walgreens. But Milky Way was such a big hit, and he had some trouble. But eventually, he decided to open up a new factory in Chicago. That was 1929. And he built this factory on the Oak Park Avenue in Chicago, which is, I think, the most beautiful candy factory ever built. Gorgeous Spanish Renaissance architecture.
It's like something you'd see in Orange County or Beverly Hills.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Beautiful. And part of his thinking was, being in a residential neighborhood, he'll get what he would probably have said is a better class of employee. He wanted good employees. He wanted, to be the biggest, most elegant, cleanest factory. It was there that not only did they make Milky Ways, but in 1932 introduced Three Musketeers. Which, I love the story. Most people don't remember, unless they're older, that it was at one point three separate bars in one package. One had a strawberry center, one had a vanilla center, one had a chocolate center. Eventually, they phased out the strawberry and vanilla. Partly strawberry, I believe, was too expensive in World War II. Then it was three bars with a chocolate center, and eventually they just, one bar with a chocolate center. So there's nothing three about Three Musketeers, but we still have the name. And then in 1930, there was introduced Snickers, which number one selling candy bar today.
Still.
Any given month, the last I heard from Mars was that in any given month, 45% of Americans will eat a Snickers. So see if you're doing your part.
I am doing my part, yeah.
But it gives you a clue to the phenomenal production capacity of Snickers. Mars, really, they are one of the largest privately held companies in the world. Today they have something like 40 factories internationally, mm-hmm. and at least 15 in the U.S. No longer headquartered in Chicago, but that factory is still in production. You would barely know it if you drive past, unless you know what it is. And they turn out thousands and thousands and thousands of candy bars a day. Mars is really known for incredibly efficient, high-tech. They pour a lot of their profits back into ever-increasing production capacity. If you see photographs of the interior of the Mars factory.
Wall Street Journal just had an article.
Right,
yeah.
The new factory in Topeka, I think. It looks like some kind of a hospital laboratory. But
hazmat suits.
It looks like it, doesn't
it?
Yeah. But what we're talking about is cleanliness, sanitation, and as much production capacity as possible. And again, think about how often have you ever checked out at a supermarket, a grocery store, a drugstore, a convenience store, anywhere in the United States, and they don't have one of their flagships, Milky Way, Three Musketeers, or Snickers there. But think about the capacity of production.
Now, Snickers, that's kind of a cute name, I guess, for sake of a better word.
Yeah, as far as I
makes
know,
you smile a little bit.
Right. I don't know any other candy bar that was named for a horse, but the story goes that they named it after. The family was a wonderful, they had tremendous horse breeding and horse racing, and that was their favorite horse in 1930.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Like so it all went right back to the horse breeding thing.
Right.
Well, we had teased a little bit before the break about Demet's Turtles. The turtle, one of my favorite candy personals. How'd that come about, the Demet brothers?
The Demet brothers, they were Greek brothers. There's a great Greek heritage in candy in Chicago. They were Greek brothers, came to Chicago, and evolved a candy chain into Demet's candy stores. And Chicago is a great home for retail candy shops. You know, people often think Fannie Mae, but there was also Andy's Candies, there was Dove Candies, if you remember the Dove bar, Dove Candies. There was Cuba Candies, there was Dutch Mill Candies, Mrs. Snyder's, Mrs. Stevens, on and on. Demet's was one of them. And at one point, the story goes that a man from New York came in and talked to one of the dippers and showed her this new candy or this great candy he found, caramel over pecans covered in chocolate. And she said, according to legend, it looks just like a turtle. Demet's very smartly trademarked the name Turtle. And then tried
to
make it
about
national.
That because I see turtles, like if you go to a vacation town, there'll be a candy store, and they'll call them turtles.
Right. And
so does Demet's get a piece of the action of that?
Yeah, no.
How do they keep track of all
but
this?
They probably will go after. I mean, the trademark has changed a little bit over mm-hmm. time. But it is true that when you go to other candy stores, you will often see under different names. Fannie Mae calls them Pixies. The great Margie's Candies in Chicago, one of the great neighborhood mm-hmm. candy shops still in operation. I think they call them Terrapins. But it was the trademark that let them take that candy nationally. Even when the Demet stores closed, they continued selling Demets and then, I mean, Turtles. The name's gone through changes. Another company owns it now, but they changed the company name to Demet's so they can continue that.
Now, if you don't want to spend a lot of money, like on a turtle, because it's an expensive candy. I would usually just get a milk dud.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the peanut or whatever, but it still has a kind of caramel chocolate thing. I always love that name, milk dud.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah,
stories.
Where does that come from?
The legend goes that the original makers, which was
dud,
the original makers were trying to make a perfectly round chocolate-covered caramel, and the machinery kept turning them out flattened. They were kind of misshapen. They were duds. So as a kind of in-joke, they took the name milk. See that in the candy industry today, but a fun legend.
We were talking about marketing before, and what I noticed in looking at your book, and particularly the photographs, it seemed like most of the appeal for candy in the early days was for women. Why was that? And when did that start to change where it was okay for a man not only to buy candy for his wife or girlfriend or whatever, but then actually eat candy too? I just thought that was an interesting gender thing.
I think that this story is so, you know, people think of candy history and they think, oh, it's fun, which it is. It's a lot of fun. But it also is really interesting. And why I always say, when you think about Chicago, people think, oh, it's a great meatpacking city. It's a great grain city. And I always want to say, it's a great candy city. And you've got to know this if you really want to understand. But candy in the early days was often sold as either something as a treat for kids, penny candy, or it was some kind of a luxury that you know, men would buy for their sweethearts. Mrs. Snyder's always opened her stores in male places where men worked because she believed men bought most of the candy to give their wives. World War I is the first time that you really see candy in a bar format, and the candy bar changes the way we eat candy. Hershey's Milk Chocolate was the first candy bar nationally sold in the U.S. That was 1900. Combination bars are just coming out in the teens. In Chicago, there was a Bunty Brothers came out with a Tango's bar. But during World War I, it's the first time you see candy bars being given to the soldiers. And they're perfect. They are high calorie, very palatable, fairly non-perishable by that point, and individually packaged. Perfect. So huge quantities of candy bars are being given to the doughboys. When they come home, they want the candy in a bar format. This is the first time that you see candy as something you can eat every day. It's not a treat for holidays. It's something that men can eat regularly. Anyone can eat a candy bar. And you see the 1920s, the emergence of many of our favorite brands. We just mentioned Milky Way, Milk Duds, even you know, into the early 30s with Snickers and Milky Way, Butterfinger, O. Henry. These all date to the 20s. This is the heyday of new candy bar introduction. And then it was discovered that, you know, you can create vending machines. You can't sell lemon drops very easily from a vending machine. But candy bars, that you can sell from a machine.
So the vending machine, what came first, candy or the vending machine? Well, there a combination of both?
Vending machines had been around for a while, not a huge amount of time.
But when you think of vending machine, you think of candy and then maybe soda after that.
Right, you do. And because what you need is standard sizes, and candy bars come in standard sizes. I mean, you don't need it, but it certainly increases your efficiency. And actually, this is one of the things I think Shooter Johnson Company did very well with Bit of Honey. Pretty hard to make a candy bar out of taffy, but the Bit of Honey taffy was in a shape that could be sold in not only in vending machines, but also could fit into store displays that were standardized. Standardization had a big part to do with it.
Bit of Honey goes a long, long way.
That's where you go, see? I know.
Actually, they were amazing marketers.
Yes.
And I understand, after looking at your book, that Halloween hasn't been around for centuries.
I know.
So that was all candy making.
I just looked up the National Confectioners Association. It says Americans spent $2.5 billion on candy this year.
Jeez.
For Halloween. Not just generally for Halloween. Halloween was really, 100 years ago, Halloween was about fortune-telling games. Usually if you're a girl, you know, you peel an apple peel and throw it over your shoulder and it'll make the initial of your future husband. You can try it, see if it works. But for if you were a boy, it was pranks. It was putting, you know, soaping windows and putting tacks on doors. It starts to change in the 1930s, and really trick-or-treating really starts to emerge in the modern era on the East Coast. But what Chicago candy makers did was to encourage candy bars as the thing you give out at Halloween. And when we really see it take off, trick-or-treating nationally, when it kind of gets that tipping point, and this was probably sometime, it's after, usually right after World War II, that it really tips to become massive, you know, a national thing. That's when Chicago candy makers are introducing what we would today call fun-size candy bars. Then they were called 1 cent or 2 cent
bars.
Miniature candy bars in individual sanitary packages. And even Brock's was giving out, you know, candy corn and things like that in individual containers. It was the packaging that made candy bars especially be the thing you want and that you give out for Halloween. That that's when you see it explode, to the point that by the 1960s, it's universal. Everyone's trick-or-treating. And today, it's something like, I want to say 75% of American households participate in trick-or-treating. That's huge.
Oh, it's huge.
It's huge. And Halloween is the number one holiday for candy sales for national distributed.
More so than Valentine's Day.
More so than Valentine's Day. In fact, the number two holiday is Easter.
Oh, of course.
About jelly beans and Easter baskets, right? Yeah. The number three holiday would be Christmas and the winter holidays. Mm-hmm. And then Valentine's Day is number four. We associate it so
flowers.
Much with love and romance. Yeah. And chocolate is romance. So.
Just imagine Jelly Bellies. They're over here in North Chicago.
There is a Jelly Belly Factory.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So when did that come about?
The Golitz Candy Factory is very old.
Golitz.
Golitz was the original
right.
name. Gustav and Hermann Golitz are usually considered the great founders of it. They started in Belleville, down in near St. Louis, way back, I think it was the 1860s, started making chicken feed, which was the ancient name for candy corn.
Oh,
they still say they've been making candy corn longer than any company. Moved their factory to North Chicago in about 1914, and still have a factory operating there. It wasn't until decades later, you know, into the 1970s, that an offshoot of the company was approached by someone who had this idea for a gourmet jelly bean.
Oh, I thought that was a long... Okay.
Yeah, it was fairly recent, really. There's a great movie about it. And he asked the Golitz company to make it, which they started doing, creating these beans and flavors like root beer and tangerine.
Coffee.
Gourmet flavors, right. And they were kind of slow to take off, but got this massive marketing boost. Particularly, they got a number of good things, but particularly when a certain United States president announced
that. That's exactly true.
I mean, that's phenomenal marketing. I want to say they shipped something like 7,000 Jelly Bellies to the first Reagan-Bush inauguration. You used to be able to go trick-or-treating at the White House and get Jelly Bellies. They now are headquartered in California, but they still have a family operation component to them, just like Ferrara does. And they still have a factory in North Chicago, and they have that distribution plant in Pleasant Prairie where you can go, and they can show you how.
Yeah, I took my kids years ago. Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful story.
You know, most factories, candy is a very secretive business, and most candy companies don't offer tours.
Oh.
But that's one of the few places you can go to and actually
see. Is that because of the ingredients or the way they
make it? Tremendous competition and great, you know, everybody, when you had to guard your candy recipes with your life, a lot of secrecy, but it's also sanitation. You know, mm-hmm. everybody wants to take a tour of a candy factory, but you can't let people in like they used to.
We haven't talked about licorice.
No, yes.
And so that's another American
licorice company, in Chicago. They are famous today because they make red vines and super ropes.
Right.
But famous mostly for snaps. Yeah, those little pastel-colored licorice.
Odd candy, but they're kind of addicting.
They're very addicting. Right. They are.
And they're only 2 cents versus the nickel.
That's a good marketing thing. They actually were in Chicago for a long time, moved to Alsip, and now they have other factories out on the West Coast. But their Alsip factory is still in production today. I love the story that it was American Licorice that made a licorice boot for Charlie Chaplin to eat in the Gold Rush.
If you've seen that silent film, the first thing that goes through your head when he's there eating the boot.
He's starving, so he boils
kind
a shoe eats it.
It's a little bit about the Donner Party.
Right. He was inspired by the Donners, who said they have to eat their shoes. It was a terrible tragedy. And yet he saw this gem of humor. What if he boils a shoe and, you know, he twirls the laces like spaghetti? And the funny thing about that is that the shoe was licorice.
It's a big boot.
And it's a big boot. And the guy
with the laces and everything. It's amazing.
And of course, this is a movie, so they're doing multiple takes. And his co-star in that scene, who's a big guy, he was said that by the end of the film, he'd have to eat so much licorice. He was ill for days from so much.
Well, I tell you, we are talking to Leslie Goddard and learning so much about candy history in Chicago. And her book is Chicago Sweet Candy History by Arcadia. We'll learn more about Chicago candy right after we take this period talking about this period. What am I saying? This hour, the Chicago sweet candy history, and such amazing stories about Snickers and Milk Duds and Demet's Turtles and so on and so forth. And you know what? We've got to talk about the smell, too. I mean, when you come in Chicago, it smells like candy.
Right, yeah. Right.
And what about Blommers?
So I was going to say, when people get off the train and it smells like someone's making chocolate chip cookies, that's off of the Blommer Chocolate Company. They are right at 600 Kinzie, right where the Chicago River splits, and they've been there since 1939. They came to Chicago because they said this is where their customers, the candy makers, were. They are the biggest wholesale manufacturer of chocolate in the United States.
Oh, I didn't know.
They have several plants, not just in Chicago, but the Chicago one is still in operation in that location. Hershey makes the most retail chocolate. The Blommer makes the most wholesale chocolate. If you go to your local supermarket and buy a chocolate cake, or you get chocolate chip strawberries at your local bakery, chances are the chocolate came from Blommer. It's amazing.
You know, we've talked about the success of Blommer and Curtis and Wrigley and all these guys. But then, those were sort of the boom years. And the candy industry started to have a little bit of a downturn for a while. I'm thinking of the Fannie Mae bankruptcy.
Right.
When did it all start to kind of change? Though it still looks like Mars and some of these big companies are going strong.
But it's not quite the way it was. It's not what it was. The fact is that made Chicago a great candy center really stopped meaning quite as much in the late 60s, 70s, 80s. And you really start to see the decline beginning in the 80s when, there's not really a moment you can identify, but one of the big trends in candy in the last half of the 20th century was mergers and acquisitions. Many of our favorite brands were acquired by other larger companies. Milk Duds are today made by Hershey's, if you want to buy.
And that was Holloway.
Right, yes, Milk J. Holloway. Right. Holloway's Milk Duds are now Hershey Milk Duds. Whoppers, which were made by Saw Leaf's Leaf Candy Company.
Wrigley was absorbed by Mars. That's
huge. The area of Mars. Yeah. For a while, that was the biggest confectioner in the United States. Kraft is today, not as much, but they are the biggest confectioner in the world because they purchased Cadbury. Mergers and acquisitions really changed the whole face of the candy industry. Today, the two big giants, Mars and Hershey, control about two-thirds of the average candy aisle. Very hard for small candy makers to even get their products on the shelf. Mm-hmm. Where you see the continuing trend in Chicago candy, I would say, in Chicago's continued candy dominance, part of the reason I would say, we still have some of the big giants here. Tootsie Roll is still headquartered and makes things in Chicago. They've been here since 1966. Tootsie Roll is here. Mars is here. Nestle has a plant here.
Curtis is owned by Nestle.
Oh. Ferrara Pan Candy. Ferrara just merged with Rick Sparley's and Sather's a few years ago, which owns Brock's. So they're still in Chicago. Fannie Mae, which went bankrupt for a while, came back. Mm-hmm. They're owned by 1-800-Flowers, but they're still headquartered in Chicago. And even more than that, I would say, Chicago is still a big center for candy innovation. If you look at a place like Vosges Chocolat, which is making these wonderful, exotic, artisanal chocolates with, red chilies and bacon in them, it's a real font of innovation in candy. You'll also see the rise of retro candy stores. Chicago has some fabulous candy shops that specialize in vintage candies. And phenomenal stores still around the Fudge Pot on Wells Street, Margie's Candies, Cupid Candies. If anyone wants
to. So it's kind of these boutique stores that are coming.
Boutique stores, places you can go and get hand-dipped chocolates made the old-fashioned way. The other Valentine's Day, I took a trip down to Cupid Candies on the south side of Chicago just because I love their version of the Turtles with caramel and cashews and bothered to die.
I am getting hungry. Okay, before we go, though, what is your favorite? We've talked about so much. What is your favorite Chicago-made candy?
I gotta say, I am a classic Chicago girl. If I had to sit down, if I'm sitting there with a candy bowl in front of me, I'm going to reach for Butterfinger, or I'm going to reach for a Snickers bar. I mean, it's peanut butter and chocolate. It's the classic American taste.
Plus, lots of energy, remember?
And lots of energy. So if I need to go out and run 2 miles, I'm set.
Well, I tell you what, this has just been such a pleasure. And Leslie Goddard, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
you wish to contact Leslie and learn more about her book, Chicago's Sweet Candy History by Arcadia Publishing, go to her website, www.lesliegoddard.info. And thank you for tuning in. I hope to drop by again next Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.